Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is Dario Fernandez Morera, an associate professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese at Northwestern University. Dr. Fernandez Morera has a broad array of research interests covering everything from Islamic Spain to encounters between Europeans and Amerindians in the 15th and 16th century, as well as critiques of modern academia. He has rented and edited several books, including The Lyre and the Oaten Flute, Garcilaso and the Pastoral, Europe and its Encounters with the Amerindians, Cervantes in the English-speaking World, and Academia in the Survival of Marxist Ideas. He has also penned several other books and numerous articles. His most recent work, which is due out in February 2016 from the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, is The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise, Muslims, Christians, and Jews Under Islamic Rule in Medieval Spain, which will be the topic of our conversation today. In addition to serving on the U.S. Council for the Humanities, Dario also earned an award for graduate teaching excellence from the School of Continuing Studies at Northwestern University in 2008. Dario, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony, for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, this is a podcast that is primarily devoted to the social scientific study of religion, and thus we usually focus folks from sociology, political science, history, and economics. And it tends to be uncommon, though not entirely rare, that we have somebody come in from the humanities and talk about their research. But your book caught my eye when it came across my desk, since you are a professor of languages, and we usually categorize that in the humanities. But your book has a very social scientific vibe to it. And I'm one of these folks who tends to think that when you have a professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese, you're only going to be writing about conjugating verbs and punctuation and proper sentence structure. So dispel me about this myth. What do professors in the languages department write about? And then also, how did you come to write about the topic of religious conflict in medieval Spain?
Well, the misunderstanding is understandable. It happens, though, that research in research universities, tenure and tenure track professors of English and foreign language do not actually teach courses on how to write English or how to write and speak a foreign language, except in an ancillary fashion. You know, you correct somebody's mistakes during the teaching and research. We are actually paid to do research and teach a subject rather than teach a language. So the subject of research and teaching for professors in a language or English literature department can be very wide and heterogeneous. For example, I have here a description of a class in English literature in the English department at a very good university. I will not mention the name. And the title of this literature class is The Age of Imperialism. And the description of the class reads, it will examine some of the central theories and interpretations of European imperialism. It will explore the historical conditions of certain imperialized regions. And it will confront some of the most lucid and powerful literary encounters with imperialism in the 20th century. And the general statement is, nothing marks the modern world so much as the devastating and disruptive effects of imperialism. Again, this is an English literature class in an English department. And the same goes for courses in language departments taught by tenure track faculty. We could teach a class on how capitalism gave rise to the modern novel, or how Marxist philosophy can elucidate the writings of Balzac or Flaubert or Dickens, for that matter. So the subjects we deal with can be very very heterogeneous. In fact, the professor who popularized the idea of convivencia in Islamic Spain was a literary scholar, and his name was Americo Castro, and he was trained as a philologist. So that shows you the actual situation here.
Yeah, it sounds like you're doing a lot of stuff that I do in some of these departments, political science and sociology and history. So very interesting. How did you end up choosing to write on the topic of religious conflict in medieval Spain? Because I'm looking at your vita here, and you have things such as the lyre and the oud and flute, Garcilaso and the pastoral, and Cervantes and the English-speaking world. Those are some topics you've discussed before in your own research. How did you come upon this one about examining Andalusian Spain?
Well, along the lines of the type of approaches that we use in language and English literature departments, we come from different angles to illuminate a particular literary text. And thinking about it, the whole thing may have begun when I wrote a piece called Cervantes and Islam, a Contemporary Analogy, and that necessitated that I do quite a bit of research into the situation of Islamic domination in Spain, and even after Islam had ended its domination, the conflict between Christianity and Islam, of which Cervantes was a central part. He fought at the Battle of Lepanto against the Muslim Turks. It was one of the great victories of Christian Europe, and Cervantes was there. He was fighting at the Battle of Lepanto, and in fact, he was ill when the battle started, but he wanted to fight, and so he came out of his bed and asked his superior to allow him to fight. And you know, they needed men, so they put him in the most dangerous part of the ship, and he fought there, and he was wounded. He was shot 3 times. He was shot twice in the chest and one on the left hand. And he recovered from the wounds in the chest, but never from the one on the left hand, so he remained lame for the rest of his life. So that started me to do research on the matter. And this article somehow landed in the desk of the editor for Easy Books. And he wrote back to me, he mailed me, asking me if I could write an article on Islamic Spain for Easy, and I did. And he liked it so much that he said, "Why don't you write a book?" And that's how it started. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And Easy is the publisher of the book. That's the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, if I'm correct.
Right.
Right. So let's go ahead and talk about the book. It is an interesting read, and it elucidated a lot of things that I did not know, or some myths and preconceptions that I had had. The book is called The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise, Muslims, Christians, and Jews Under Islamic Rule in Medieval Spain. Let's go ahead and start with the basics for people who might not be familiar with this era. When we talk about Andalusian or medieval Spain, what time frame are we looking at?
Well, for Islamic Spain itself, or Al-Andalus, as it was partly known, especially in by Muslims, the time frame is from around 711 of after Christ to approximately the end of the 13th century. By the end of the 13th century, most of Islamic Spain had been reconquered by the Christian warriors, and the Muslim control was confined to the small kingdom of Granada, which remained under Muslim rule until 1492, when it was defeated by the Catholic monarchs Isabel and Fernando, Isabel de Castilla and Fernando de Aragon. So that's the time frame, from the beginning of the 8th century to the end of the 13th. most of the Reconquista was over, and then it was finished in 1492.
Now, Spain was part of the Roman Empire, and that eventually crumbled. So how and when did Muslims arrive and conquer the peninsula?
Well, they, as I said, they arrived around 711. There was first some a razzia or an incursion by a guy named Tarif, and he returned to North Africa with a lot of booty and a lot of slaves. And one of the Muslim historians says that these were the most beautiful women that the Muslims had ever seen. And then after that, the Muslim leader in North Africa, Musa ibn Nusair, sent a scouting force. That was a standard procedure in the Muslim conquest. You send a smaller force to probe the defenses of the enemy. So he may have sent several thousand warriors rather than a huge army. And this scouting force was very successful. And in defeating the initial resistance. And so Musa then sent a larger army, which eventually conquered most of the peninsula. Not all. The north west remained unconquered, but it conquered most of the territory in about 10 years.
Now, this seems like the traditional conquering. There's a lot of resources to take over during this period of time, so let's go and get the wealth. Were there other motives that motivated the Muslims to conquer the peninsula?
Well, the main motivation was religion, to carry out a holy struggle to make this land and other lands submit to Islam. That was the main motivation of the Muslim conquest. And, of course, the benefits of loot and slaves were additional incentives and very strong ones. So those were the motives.
Now, one of the things that I found interesting in your book, and this is, I think, something that helped correct me, you focused on Spain rather than Iberia. And you make a point about differentiating the two. So explain what you're doing there in terms of the territory that you're examining.
Well, in the Middle Ages, nobody called the land that we call Spain Iberia. Iberia is a pre-Roman name, and the Romans, you know, started the conquest of Spain in the 3rd century before Christ. But Iberia is a pre-Roman name used by Greek geographers. The Romans called the land Hispania, which is a Latin word, which evolved into Spania and then into España. And so the Romans did not call the land Iberia. Nobody did. The people of the Middle Ages, both Christians and Muslims and even scholars until the 1990s, did not call it Iberia, but España. That is España. So in medieval times, the name that designated this land and culture was España. And the inhabitants did not call themselves, and nobody called them Iberians. But Muslims or Christians, if they live in the north, or Spanish, as the Christians called those in the south who remained under Islamic domination. They were called Spanish, that is, Spaniards. Since the 1990s, scholars have borrowed the term Iberia for political reasons. Before the 1990s, all scholars called it Spain and referred to it as medieval Spain. So that's why I call it medieval Spain, or medieval Iberia, which makes no sense.
So in terms of the conquest of Spain, when Muslims came in the 700s, the early 8th century, it wasn't just Spain that they conquered. They actually extended their rule fairly significantly. You mentioned they didn't get the northwest part of Spain, but how did the territorial expansion of Muslims during this period of time extend?
Well, the expansion began from Arabia, no? From Arabia, the land of Muhammad, where he started this very powerful religion. then the Arabs moved on to the Middle East, which was Christian at the time. It was under the control of the Greek Christian Roman Empire, also known as Byzantine, although nobody called it Byzantine at the time. That's another invention of scholars. And so they defeated the Greeks in the Middle East and conquered the Middle East, and then they defeated the Persian Empire. And they conquered the Persians, what is today Iran. So they conquered the Persian Empire, and then they moved on to North Africa, which was also Christian territory. It was, again, territory controlled by the Christian Greek Roman Empire. And they defeated the troops of the empire in northern Africa, and then defeated a number of Berber tribes and incorporated them into their armies. And then eventually conquered the whole of North Africa, which was, again, I repeat, Christian territory. I mean, that's the land of Augustine of Hippo and Tertullian of Carthage and Athanasius of Alexandria. So it's a fascinating cultural change that took place.
And then they also expanded fairly significantly into Europe as well. They came up through the Spanish Peninsula, and then moved up all the way almost to what is contemporary.
After they consolidated the grip in most of Spain, they then tried to do the same in Europe, and so they crossed the Pyrenees. But there they faced a different enemy, which was not divided like the Visigoths were in Spain. They were very unified, and under the leadership of a very great warrior named Charles Martel. And Martel defeated them. Defeated them at a famous battle of Tours, Battle of Poitiers. And that basically stopped the movement. I mean, they tried several other incursions later on, but they were never successful after their defeat at Poitiers or Tours, Battle of Tours.
Now, you mentioned that one of the reasons that the Muslim invading armies were able to conquer Spain is because there's divisions within the Visigoths. And was that one of the reasons that they were able to hold that territory for a significant period of time?
That was the reason, the main reason for the success of the initial conquest. The kingdom was politically weak. The monarchy was not hereditary, it was elective. And it was elective. The king was elected by a number of powerful noble families. And of course, at the point of the invasion, one faction from those noble families was unhappy with the choice of the king, whom they considered a usurper. And so they sided with the Muslims, and that was decisive. There was also some cooperation from the Jewish community there, which also helped the rapid movement of the Muslim troops.
Was it the case that the Jewish communities were irritated by the rule of the king at the time, or what were their other motivations?
The Jewish community had been oppressed by anti-Jewish rules for a few centuries, so it was quite understandable that they sided with invaders.
How did the Muslims rule politically and economically at this time? We're going to move on to religious matters in a second here, but I'm interested in what type of rule did they establish? Was this a distant rule? Was it more physically located there, set up an entrenched dynasty? What was the political and economic situation at the time?
Well, the situation is one of religious control. This is very difficult to understand for Western scholars. There was no distinction into political control, economic control. All that was subordinated to one kind of control. A control that goes to the core, or rather an emotional and physical investment in something that goes to the core of the individual, or at least to many individuals, and that therefore affects the entire social life of a state, and that is religion. Western scholars have a terrible time understanding that. So they're always beating about the bush. Oh, well, you know, but what were the political motivations and what were the material causes? No, it doesn't work in a case like this. Everything was subordinated to religion, economic policy, politics, all that was subordinate to religion. That was the central and most important thing. And I repeat, Western scholars have a really, really hard time accepting that.
I think that is an interesting case, because oftentimes we tend to take a look at our own culture, our own historical period of time, and project it backwards and think about people living at that time according to what we consider to be our standards and our values today.
Our categories of understanding. You know, what were the political motivations? What were the economic motivations? Well, it must have been economics, you know. No. Economics was there. Political decisions were there. But behind all that was religion.
In terms of the rule of Christianity at the time, too, was there a separation between political rule and religious rule? I think many scholars might look back and say, well, you know, at the time, yes, the Muslims ruled with a unification of politics and religion, but could one say the same of Christianity, or was it different?
Yes, that is a valid question. Well, what happens is that in Christian Europe, there was something called religious law. And that religious law was the law that applied to monks and priests and other members of the church. And it was called canon law. The rest of the population was not ruled by religious law. It was ruled by a legal system that was influenced by Christianity, but that it was also influenced and coming from other sources, such as Roman law, which was pagan in origin, common law, which was derived from the actual practices of the population, and Germanic law, which was derived from the customs of the Germanic invaders of the Roman Empire, and of course the people who interpreted and applied that non-religious law were not priests, and they were not monks; they were lay people. So you have a distinction here between religious law and non-religious law, which made no sense in Islamic Spain. I don't know if I have explained that clearly.
Mm-hmm. No, that is an important clarification. I think this leads into a lot of our other discussion as well, that the political and religious realm within Andalusian Spain ruled by the Muslims was categorically different than what you would see in other parts of Christian Europe. So let's go ahead and talk about Muslim rule during this period of time. And when the Muslims invade, they gave Christians and Jews three options underneath their rule. And you write about this. What are those three options?
The choice was to convert or to submit as a sort of third or fourth or fifth level of subalternity in a system of extortion called the jizya. You paid to be allowed to practice your religion within your own community, no public displays. Or the other choice, of course, was to fight and be killed and enslaved if you were defeated. There was a fourth choice, which is to flee or try to flee. So those were the choices. There were choices, after all. Dire choices, but choices.
You mentioned the jizya, and that would be equivalent to basically a religious tax. How was this applied, and was it a usurious rate? Was it 95%? Was it 10%? Do we have any idea of what that was?
It varied. In the initial invasion, they were allowed to pay in things other than coinage. You know, they had to give cattle oil, wheat, all sorts of other things. But basically, it was a system of extortion. You pay to be allowed. It's like what gangsters use, protection. It was called protection. You're protected, but you have to pay for it. And like gangsters do, you know, it depends on how much they think they can get out of the particular victim. It was called the jizya. And the protected people were called protected. It's a very interesting use of rhetoric. You're protected. Actually, you're being extorted.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a system of extortion.
Now, it's interesting that Christianity did not die out during the time. So there must have been people who refused to convert to Islam, who did not flee, and who were not killed. So they submitted to the jizya, the religious tax, so to speak. What do we have an idea of what portion of the native population chose to go ahead and just pay that tax?
Well, the portion who converted or submitted or fled varied over time. And this was a continuous process. It's not like, well, a certain number of people converted and that's it, and the rest didn't convert. No. This was a continuous process going over time. It seems clear that the number of those who converted and became Muslims over time increased, which is logical because of the circumstances. And in fact, Christianity did die out in many places. In Granada, for example, when the Christian monarchs entered the kingdom and the city of Granada itself in 1492, there were no Christians. They had become extinct. In Valencia, the same thing had happened. In other places, that had happened too. There were no Christians left. And we can find today no churches in southern Spain dating back to the Islamic domination. They're all gone. So, yes, they did disappear eventually in many places in Islamic Spain.
So you mentioned Granada and Valencia as places where Christianity essentially became extinct. Were there other parts of Spain where Christianity had a stronger foothold? Because eventually the Christians came back and reunified the country.
Well, as I said earlier, what happened was that in the initial conquest, there were some areas that were not conquered. The Muslims could not conquer them. That was the northwest of Spain, the region of Asturias and Galicia. That's a mountainous region. The people there are very tough. And the forces, the Christian forces that chose to flee from Islamic Spain upon the conquest went there. Some of them went to France, but some others went there. So there was resistance there. And that resistance increased over time and began to extend itself more and more. So the Christians from those areas began to reconquer more and more Muslim-held territory. And that took several centuries until, as I said, by the 13th century, the Christians had reconquered most of the land. So that was about 5 centuries or so of struggle, intermittent struggle. Sometimes there was peace, sometimes there was war, sometimes the Christians were fighting with each other, sometimes they requested Muslim help to fight with each other. So it was a very fluid situation, but if you look at it from the long distance, then you can see the gradual movement of Christianity back toward the south until finally they reconquered the entire land.
Now, your book seeks to directly dispel the myth of Islamic rule. That's part and parcel of the title there. What is the nature of this myth, and how did it originate?
Well, that's not an easy thing to answer. It may originate in the Enlightenment, in the Enlightenment's search for alternatives to a despised Christianity, or weapons to use against a despised Christianity by many members of the Enlightenment, or at least not so much Christianity as the Catholic Church. So we say, look, compared to how barbarous this Catholic Church is, look how enlightened this Islamic rule was. So that would be one source for the origin of this myth. Another is the 19th century search for exoticism. You know, you look for, writers look for places which are exotic and different, and then they romanticize it. You know, European writers wrote about the wonderful romantic life of the Indians in the Americas. We know, in fact, that it was far less romantic than that. And Spain was another one. You know, look at how exotic and interesting and romantic this land is. And then the more recent versions of this myth echo, in a way, these two sources, but they add a number of other motivations. There's one called, that one could call Occidentalism. There is also the self-serving needs in Islamic studies. There is also money from Islamic nations granted to Western universities, and so on and so forth. And these motives can be unearthed by hermeneutics of suspicion. So that's it.
So this is very interesting, because the myth of a tolerant Andalusian rule during this period of time, it dates back in history, goes back to the Enlightenment, to the 19th century, and then again is reemphasized in recent writings of scholars. And so it's out there quite a bit. And so when you approached writing your book, and your book really swims against the tide of this and trying to expose these myths, how did you go about researching this, and what sources of information did you use? Did you go back to texts back in the 1400s or 1200s, etc.?
My evidence comes from many different sources. I use literary sources, religious sources, archaeological sources, biographical sources, and so on. So I don't use a single source. I use many different ones. And the method, the hermeneutical principle used in my book is the hermeneutical principle of multiple attestations. And the inspirational approach, if you will, for my book is Machiavelli. Machiavelli was a true genius in the examination of human actions.
That's a very interesting inspiration to cite here, Machiavelli. What motivates that use of Machiavelli?
I've always found very very interesting and likable the way he goes about analyzing human actions. He is a very, shall we say today in another form, a realistic analyst of human actions. He tries to examine things as they really are, and not as we might wish them to be.
I find that
very, very attractive.
Yeah, I think that is one of the attractive aspects of your book as well, because we oftentimes tend to romanticize things that have happened in the past, and we think that we are, as humans, are very different than we were back in the past. But humans have been humans for a very long period of time, and we're filled with many wonderful things and also many not so wonderful things. And that's one of the things that you're dealing with here. So let's go ahead and talk about some of the myths that you dispel. And one of the nice things about your book, and for people who are, well, would like to pick it up and read it, we'll put a link to it on our website, is that you give citations in the literature of these myths, of people using these in their various scholarly works, and then go ahead and dissect these. So let's go ahead and start out with the issue of religious tolerance, since that seems to be one of the biggest ones there. You approach this topic of religious tolerance with an eye towards the legal structure in Andalusia, Spain, and note that it was a heriocratic society. What does heriocratic mean, and what are the implications for Christians and Jews and religious tolerance during this period of time?
Yes, a hierocracy is a government of clerics, and in Islamic that structure society, and these texts were interpreted and applied by religious clerics who were experts in this religious text. And the implications were that Christians and Jews were in a subaltern position, as indicated by the interpretation and application of these texts. So it was a result of that.
Now, you mentioned something called the Maliki school of jurisprudence that tended to predominate during this period of time. What is that?
That is one of the main schools of Islamic law. And it was founded in the second half of the 8th century after Christ by a guy named Malik ibn Anas, who was a native of Medina. And that was the school of Islamic jurisprudence that prevailed in Islamic Spain, and according to which Islamic law was applied throughout Islamic Spain. That's what Malikism is. It's one of the schools, main schools of Islamic jurisprudence.
And so how did this actually play out in day-to-day life for Christians and for Jews and for others in terms of tolerance and freedom? Talk about issues of religious freedom. We often think about blasphemy and apostasy, and that is permitted. How did the Islamic Spanish period fare out on this?
Well, the religious laws indicate very clearly that Christians and Jews are, shall we say, have been misled, and they do not practice the true religion. And so they are, by definition, subaltern, in a position of inferiority to the true believers. That then had all sorts of consequences, as you can imagine. This did not preclude that the Christians, most capable among them, were used, especially in the initial conquest, to serve the Muslim rulers. On the contrary, they could be used as bureaucratic servants. And they were necessary because the cultural level of the Muslim invaders initially was very, very low. So they needed capable functionaries from the conquered population to run the place. As conversions increased, of course, the number of Christians and even Jews used as functionaries would decrease. That was particularly true of the Christians. But the religious teachings of the Maliki school are very clear on this subject. Christians and Jews are inferior. And the jizya, in fact, is intended not only to extract wealth from them, but also to show them that they are inferior. That is very clearly stated in the Maliki text. The jizya is intended to humiliate them. So, that's it.
In terms of day-to-day practices, such as wine and song, I mean, you talk about this in your book, were Christians allowed to continue drinking? I mean, Spain is noted well for its wine. Were these practices that were allowed to continue, saying, oh, you're Christians, that's okay?
Well, as in the case of the practice of the religion, they were allowed to do so within their own communities. they were punished very severely if they were found drinking outside their own communities, or if by chance they sold any wine to a Muslim, they could be killed. So, yes, wine continued to be consumed in the Christian community. It was forbidden by law, however, in the Islamic communities. And, of course, this was not the case in Christian Europe. We know that, in fact, the English, the Scottish, and the Dutch Puritans kept beer cellars, and they drank wine. They drank beer even for breakfast. Now, in Islamic Spain, of course, there would be people who violated the religious laws, like they are everywhere. The rich, you know, would get away with it, certainly the more powerful ones, and the drunkards who wouldn't care.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of punishments were meted out if a Christian was caught selling wine to someone else or consuming it in public?
He could be killed.
Really?
Yeah, he could be killed.
What about other issues such as blasphemy, speaking out against Islam? I would assume that that would not be very much tolerated at this time.
Blaspheming against God or Muhammad was punished with beheading or crucifixion, and there was no possibility of repentance if there was someone who blasphemed against God or against the Prophet. And, of course, blasphemy would take many different forms, you know. And we don't have to go into the details, because it would be the clerics who would decide that's blasphemy against the Prophet.
So,
and then you should be killed.
So it's not just necessarily a straightforward declaration, but it could vary according to anybody's interpretation. It could include different types of behaviors, I would imagine.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. If it was declared blasphemy against the Prophet, the punishment was death. There was no possibility of repentance.
Now, one of the things that you talk about, or a term that you used earlier on in the interview here, was convivencia, and that's living together. And one of the myths that is oftentimes talked about from the Enlightenment period and other periods is that this was a period where Christians and Muslims lived side by side and interacted with one another very easily. To what extent was that a myth, and what was really the situation there in terms of Christians interacting with Muslims?
As I said earlier, this the concept of convivencia was, if not invented, certainly popularized by this literary scholar named Americo Castro. Unfortunately, it doesn't have a factual basis, and if you look at the documents, you will see that that was not the case, both in practice and in theory. In theory, it could not be the case, because a number of religious laws made that very difficult, if not impossible. Eating with a Christian, for example, was not legally possible. You could not sit at the equivalent then of a restaurant, let's be facetious here, sit at a restaurant, you know, and have dinner with Christians. That was not possible. Why? Because the Christians ate food that was forbidden by Islamic law, and so a Muslim could be committing a sin by partaking of that food, or even putting his food on a plate where Christian food had been before. So the eating was not possible. Entering a house of a Christian or a Jew presented similar problems, because the house was polluted by the Christian practices in eating and other things. There might be icons there. There might be a sculpture, or there may be less likely, but some kind of a painting there of a saint, which is no. So that would not be legally possible. Drinking from the same well was not legally possible. Why? Because again, the water might be contaminated by the Christian or the Jew. Touching, for the same reasons, would not be legally possible. Christians were even forbidden to walk in Muslim cemeteries because their mere presence might pollute the tombs or the buried Muslims there. And then, of course, there was the problem of subalternity involved here for Christians and Jews. They were inferior to Muslims. So those were serious obstacles to this convivencia that Professor Castro was so much fond of. Now, of course, given what we know of human nature, and you mentioned earlier, you know, that humans are capable of good behavior also, we would probably have some people who would violate the law, you know. They might befriend a Christian or befriend a Jew. But violating the law happens everywhere. It's not peculiar to Islamic Spain. Look, in this country, the law is violated constantly, even by the authorities. We know about that. Immigration laws are not implemented. Traffic laws are not implemented. You see bicycles that run through red lights and stop signs. You have sanctuary cities, all sorts of things that show that here, too, the law can be violated. Bribery, you know, is another factor. But violating the law in Islamic Spain, if you were found guilty, could have very dire consequences.
And dire consequences, not only for Christians, but for Muslims as well, right? So if you saw a Muslim and a Christian eating together, the Christian might be punished, but would the Muslim be as well?
Yes, you would, because he was violating religious law by eating food that was not halal, approved. And, you know, as I said, blasphemy, what was the top offense? There was also the question of adultery, you know, on the part of a free Muslim who had been properly married. If that Muslim was convicted of adultery, he would be killed by stoning to death. Punishment, by the way, which is still used in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Also blasphemy punishments with death are also used in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. We don't make much of that because Saudi Arabia isn't ally of us. So our government doesn't go after Saudi Arabia, but it's still done there.
Now, speaking of adultery, that brings up the issue of gender relations, and you have a chapter in your book that deals with this, and some scholars have noted that Andalusia, Spain, or Muslim-ruled Spain, was remarkably more relaxed for women compared to other places in the Arab world and some places in the Christian world. What was the case that you found?
That is a lot of nonsense. The evidence from the laws and from the biographies indicate that free Muslim women lived lives far more modestly than women in Christian Europe. Their behavior was much more modest, and their way of dressing was much more modest. The veil was standard for free Muslim women. And staying at home was also standard for them as well. That was not the case in Christian Europe, for good or for bad. I mean, look, They might argue that was a good thing, because women were supposed to be very modest. But that was not the way it was in Christian Europe. In medieval Spain, you had women working in the fields as cattle maids. Mm-hmm. That would have been inconceivable for a free Muslim woman in Islamic Spain. So all that is nonsense.
One of the other chapters that you bring up too deals with this myth of the golden age for Jews during Andalusia, Spain. What can you tell us about that? How were Jews treated? Were they treated worse than Christians, the same as Christians, perhaps better?
The Jewish community was treated better under Islam than it had been treated under Christianity prior to the Islamic invasion. Why? Not because Islam considered Jews better than Christians considered Jews, or not because Islam considered Jews as better than Christians. Actually, it was the other way around. Muslims considered Christians a little better than Jews. So why were Jews treated better? Because the Islamic rulers needed and used the Jewish community as a counterpoise to the initially larger Christian population. This is standard procedure in military conquest. You use some minority group as help against the group that you have just defeated. Many, many examples throughout history. The United States has used that in Iraq, for example. Now we have used the Shiites, who were subaltern under Hussein, and we used them against Hussein. Then we used the Sunnis against the Shiites. We have played that kind of game ourselves. Every conqueror plays that kind of game. So the rulers did as well. So they used Jews as servants to get around the prohibition of making alliances with infidels. In Islamic law, you cannot ally yourself with Christians or Jews. So to get around that, you say, well, we are not their allies, we are our servants. But the religious texts of the Maliki school are clear on the religious inferiority of Jews as well as Christians.
Mm-hmm. Now, this book is, which will be coming out in February of 2016, is sure to make some waves in academia. And although it won't be out published for another couple months here, your thoughts on this topic have been published in a number of other academic publications, so I'm sure you've discussed your thoughts with other colleagues. What has been the general reaction to your thoughts on this topic?
Well, some earlier articles of mine have been cited by some academics, and I have had very positive reading from a number of scholars, and if you buy the book, you will see the on the cover, on the back cover, you will see some of the statements by those academic scholars. But I have no illusions about the majority of scholars who have invested their entire life of research on a particular view of Islamic Spain. But they are all of a sudden going to say, you know, I was basically wrong. You know, I written 3 books on this. I spent 30 years researching and teaching, and I was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's very hard.
I don't expect that to happen, frankly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see how this book is received, and it'll be coming out in a couple months, so we're looking forward to that. One final question I have, and I always like to ask this of my guests, is in the process of doing the research for this book and a writing of this book, was there anything that tended to surprise you, or did you learn something that changed the way you thought about the world or you hadn't thought about before?
Well, I've been surprised, to put it that way. I've been surprised, but I have been rather reaffirmed in my belief that we humans have an enormous capacity for self-deception and for deceiving others in the process, to tell you the truth. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, I can imagine. And this, your book, The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise, Muslim Christians and Jews Under Islamic Rule in Medieval Spain, helps to dispel some of the myths that are out there and some of our self-delusions. My guest today has been Dario Fernandez Morera. Dario, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
And thank you for inviting me. I have enjoyed talking to you, Tony. Good luck.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic,
participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.